Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Working hard to get the judge to hear our voices, literally, collectively, tens of thousands, if not hundreds.
Alaska's congressional delegation files an amicus brief to try to stop an injunction against the Willow Oil Drilling Project. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Indigenous radio show produced by an Anchorage-based company accepts a medal from President Joe Biden.
We're Americans, and I'm proud to be an American. And that day there in the White House, I've never been prouder.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's 3 universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
A federal judge could issue a decision as early as next week to temporarily halt construction of Willow, ConocoPhillips' controversial oil drilling project in the National Petroleum Reserve. 2 lawsuits filed by environmental groups and an Inupiat advocacy organization aim to overturn the Biden administration's approval of Willow. The plaintiffs have asked for an injunction to halt construction until the case is decided. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason says she'll try to have a decision on the injunction by April 3rd. The Interior Department's decision to allow 3 drill pads and 200 oil wells was a blow to climate activists. It drew applause from ConocoPhillips and many constituencies on the North Slope, as well as Alaska's legislature and congressional delegation. The legislature and the trio who represent Alaska in Congress have taken the unusual step of jointly filing an amicus brief to offer their perspective to the judge. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan told reporters about it today.
We are working hard to get the judge to hear our voices, literally, collectively, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Alaskans, to convince her that this project going forward, of course, abides by the law, but is strongly in the public interest.
Bridget Passerianos is an attorney with the firm Trustees for Alaska and filed one of the lawsuits. She says the amicus or friend of the court brief does nothing to negate her claim that the administration failed to follow environmental laws in issuing the Willow decision.
This is unfortunately emphasizing Senator Sullivan's blinders that the state government and oil companies and our own congressional delegation from Alaska have to the impact that Willow would have on local communities and the global climate.
Nationally, opposition to the project built rapidly in February and early March. Anti-Willow videos on social media garnered millions of views, and young voters in particular say they feel President Biden violated a campaign promise. Biden said last week that he was inclined not to approve Willow, but was advised that ConocoPhillips would sue and likely win. The company has held the Willow leases since the 1990s. Last week, President Joe Biden presented medals of honor for arts and humanities, sharing the stage with celebrities like Sir Elton John and Julia Louise Dreyfus. Was Sean Spruce, host of the public radio program Native America Calling.
Being there at the White House and just, you know, as a Native person, you feel a bit conflicted, right? Because you know the history there, you know where the building stands. But, you know, I understand the United States is not a perfect country, and is the treatment of our people has had, you know, we all know the history and the stories there. But at the same time, we're Americans, and I'm proud to be an American. And that day there in the White House, I've never been prouder.
Spruce is Laguna Pueblo, The daily call-in radio show he hosts won a National Humanities Medal. It's produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, based in Anchorage. Native America Calling has been around for nearly 30 years. It airs every weekday on nearly 150 stations. More than half of them are Native-owned or controlled. Spruce attributes the show's success to finding cohesive themes for Native communities coast to coast, while also recognizing the nuances and differences that exist across Native America.
If you're a Native person, you listen to that show, and it might not be a show topic that definitely correlates directly with your community, but we always give every Native person something to take away from every one of these shows, something for them to connect with.
12 National Humanities Medals were given out this year. Native American educator Henrietta Mann was also a recipient. The Cheyenne elder created many Native American studies programs at both tribal and state universities. A heated debate over Soldotna's park policies is over for now after the Soldotna City Council quashed a series of proposed changes that would have drilled down on what is and isn't allowed in local parks 9 months after a drag performance in Soldotna Creek Park first sparked intense discussion over what's appropriate and constitutionally protected in public spaces. KDLL's Sabine Pook has more.
Wednesday's city council meeting drew a standing room only crowd of advocates and opponents who alternated hours of impassioned testimony on one of those policies, which would have made lewdness in Soldotna's public spaces a finable offense. But members of the council, including Jordan Chilson, said they didn't think the policies on the table addressed any real problems the city had, and they ultimately voted no on the ordinance.
And I think what it comes down to is sending a message. And that message that we're sending, we have to consider very carefully.
The debate over the city's policy started last summer following a Pride Month event in Soldotna Creek Park, which included performances from drag queens. While there was no pushback at the event itself, it became a target after the fact when a conservative blogger posted an 8-second clip of a performer twerking on stage. In the months following, a vocal group of local residents and business owners showed up to City Council and Parks Advisory Board meetings, demanding the city do something about what they saw as inappropriate behavior. The city, in response, said the performance was legal and protected in the Constitution as freedom of expression, but agreed to take another look at its park policies anyway. Officials crafted a series of proposed policy changes, including one that would have drilled down on what's not allowed at city parks, and another that would update the city's park reservation policies, both of which were shot down earlier this month. A third proposal barring lewdness in public spaces citywide came before the council this week. It would have made, quote, lewdness or lascivious behavior a minor offense with a $250 fine. City Attorney Brooks Chandler said, crucially, the ordinance included definitions and examples of what would be barred, such as simulations of sex or performances that would be harmful to minors.
So this ordinance really is, you know, all about the definitions.
Some of the behavior outlined in the ordinance is already barred at the state level, and city staff say the ordinance wouldn't have made a difference last summer or apply to the dancing at Pride in the Park. Still, commenters on both sides of the issue said the ordinance would send a message. Joshua Silzo of Soldotna has spoken at multiple city council meetings since last summer. He said it's important for the city to take a stance on what he and others said was an issue of morality and public decency.
We, the families, the couples that are raising children, our children here, we're raising the future of this community. And we have a right. We have a right to discuss sexuality with them in the privacy of our own homes, and not to go into the public spaces of this town and have to explain to them things that they don't need to be exposed to at their age.
But opponents of the legislation said passing laws like this one in response to Pride tells the LGBTQ plus community it's not welcome. Ash Magallanes says she's a parent and member of that community.
Please understand that your decisions, actions, and the language that you use directly contribute to how the community receives us when we leave our house, and will continue to affect ours and our children's daily lives on a daily basis, since we hope to never leave the area.
In the end, the majority of the city council said it was unclear what the ordinance was trying to accomplish. At worst, said council member Linda Farnsworth Hutchings, it would contribute to a culture of over-policing in the city.
I don't want to see everybody running around the park this summer with their iPhones, taking pictures, and then going to the chief and saying, is this something we can do something? I just can't get there from here. So I'm going to vote no for this.
She was joined by three others, and the ordinance failed in a vote of 4-2. The council could take the ordinance up again, but it would have to be reintroduced by one of the members in the majority, who voted against it on Wednesday. In Soldotna, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, dancers describe the feeling of being back on stage at this year's Chamai Dance Festival in Bethel.
It feels pretty amazing to dance in front of many other people and to see other dance groups dance and perform.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Today is the deadline to submit comments to the National Park Service on proposed changes to sport hunting and trapping regulations for Alaska National Preserves. The agency proposes to reinstate National Preserve bans put in place under President Obama in 2015 and rescinded under President Trump in 2020 on certain state-allowed hunting and trapping activities, including taking black bear cubs and sows with cubs with artificial light at den sites, harvesting bears over bait, taking wolves and coyotes during the denning season, taking swimming caribou, taking caribou from motorboats under power, and using dogs to hunt black bears. The new rule also proposes banning predator control and reduction in Alaska National Preserves. In the 1970s, Cook Inlet was home to hundreds of beluga whales. 4 decades later, you'd be lucky to see 7 at a time. The population stands at around 280 as of 2018. Mandy Magura is the author of a map studying the challenges the whales face today.
We've lost over 1,000 belugas from this population. That's a huge, significant loss.
Magura's project is focused on pinpointing the reasons why this might be happening to the belugas. Magura says the population decline is due to several factors that can be categorized as point source pollution and non-point source pollution. Point source polluters have a permit, and pollution comes from a known source.
That would be things such as wastewater treatment facilities, stormwater drains, seafood discharges.
These threats are building up for the whales, causing issues like food insecurity, compromised immunity, and noise distractions. The St. Mary's Dance Group returned to Chamai Festival in Bethel after more than a decade away. As Adeline Baxter reports, this year's festival is dedicated to the group's founder, Moses Pockin Sr.
It's opening night of the annual Chamai Dance Festival in Bethel, and half of the members of one of the featured groups aren't here yet. Inside the Bethel High School green room, where dancers wearing kusbucks and fur-lined headdresses gather to prepare for their performances, St. Mary's dance group leader George Beans and festival organizer Linda Curta are trying to buy more time.
Okay, so guess what? I'm going to go talk to these guys and see if I can get them to move up.
Weather delayed the afternoon flight scheduled to bring the rest of the dancers from the Yukon River community about 100 miles away. Travel hiccups are just another part of life on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and the St. Mary's dancers are used to delays. It's been more than a decade since the group performed here. This year's festival is dedicated to one of the group's founders, Moses Pockin Sr., a former state representative and longtime school board member in the community. Pockin died in 2017. He was meant to be recognized at the 2020 festival, but it was canceled last minute due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, finally, his wife Martha and some of his children have traveled to Bethel to receive the dedication and to dance. And Bean says it's about time.
Yeah, I've been put off for a few years, so now it's got to be the real deal now.
Luckily, Chamai's organizers are no strangers to improvising. Still, after rearranging the dancers' schedule and inviting a few unplanned speakers to the stage, they've pretty much exhausted all their options. Then, Curta takes the mic.
Guess what? St. Mary's is here. Everyone,
dancers and drummers pour onto the stage. Without pausing, they take their places, and the Yarok begins. One of the songs they perform was written by Pakun. He wrote many songs for children during his life and encouraged the youth to keep dancing. Today, the group has more than 20 members, from teenagers to octogenarians. Isabella Peterson is 16. This was her first Jamai. Despite the delays, she says it was all worth it to step out onto the stage in Bethel.
It feels pretty amazing to dance in front of many other people and to see other dance groups dance and perform.
Pausing from her dancing, Martha Pakun accepts a plaque for her husband and leads the room in the Lord's Prayer in thanks. The audience, young and old, join in.
Your legacy, Moses, your spirit lives on in the dances of St. Mary's.
In Bethel, I'm Adeline Baxter.
A University of Alaska Fairbanks graduate student is considering legal action against a startup company he co-founded. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Jonathan Kamler invented a UAF-patented PFAS remediation technology and with partners formed a startup called Aquaga to commercialize it.
The whole company was based on a foundational patent from the University of Alaska.
Kamler says Aquaga received awards, grants, and contracts based on his technology.
NSF, EPA, U.S. Air Force, Federal Aviation Administration, all of these have funded them, you know, based on that they were developing, going down this one development track, and then they switched gears and went on a different one.
Kamler says he was ousted from the now Tacoma, Washington-based company's board of directors in September 2021.
Decided they didn't need me anymore for whatever reason and kicked me to the curb and kicked my tech to the curb.
Kamler blames a breakdown in interpersonal relationships for the ouster, but former UAF entrepreneur-in-residence turned Aquaga partner and CEO Nigel Sharp maintains Kamler didn't have enough time for the company.
Jonathan didn't have the time to sort of be on the board of directors and make the decisions. There was a challenge in us getting decisions made back then, so we just, you know, shortened down the board.
Sharp says Kamler's PFAS destruction technology was dropped in favor of an approach developed at Colorado School of Mines and the University of Washington.
We're building sort of continuous flowing pressure cookers, and Jonathan's technology through the University of Alaska Fairbanks was a technology that was much more future-looking. It was like, well, how could you build these systems maybe with advanced 3D printing and that kind of stuff? But as we've done more and more customer development and more research, folks are looking to solve the real problem, aren't looking for a future, you know, unproven technology. They want something that, you know, exists now that can be built.
That's just sort of the way it goes.
UAF Center for Innovation, Commercialization, and Entrepreneurship Director Mark Billingsley says the market-driven evolution resulted in revocation of Aquaga's license for the UAF-patented technology.
We said, well, you know, you guys can't keep this technology if you're not actually commercializing it. And they were like, yeah, that's right. That's not the direction we're going. So it was an amicable break.
Though the university is no longer affiliated with Aquaga, Billingsley characterizes the experience as positive.
We've learned something through our relationship with a startup company that continues growing, and hopefully, you know, they go on to really succeed.
Billingsley and Kamler are working on new avenues for his UAF patented technology, but Kamler believes he has grounds to sue Aquaga.
You know, kicked me to the curb without cause, for one thing, complete lack of communication on what they're doing. You know, I'm still a shareholder. They won't talk to me. I still have investment dollars in there. They won't talk to me.
Meanwhile, Aquaga Sharp says the company has $1.8 million in contracts to demonstrate mobile PFAS remediation systems, including at Eielson Air Force Base and Fairbanks International Airport, and recently raised over $300,000 from investors through an online campaign. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
The Anchorage School District is asking Anchorage voters to approve a $38 million bond this April. If passed, the bond would pay for about $22 million in roof repairs, including replacing the roof at College Gate Elementary and repairing two other school roofs. Andrew Wallace is the maintenance supervisor for the district. He says every time it snows more than 6 inches, crews must respond to shovel the roofs of 9 schools built from the same prototype in the 1990s. He points to an example inside Cassoon Elementary, where plastic sheets hang down from the walls to catch water.
We have a series of leaks that are quite big, so we're trying just to funnel it all into one area to capture the water that's going off here. So that's the main purpose. We call this a drip net.
While classrooms with leaks are empty for now, next year 150 students who currently attend Abbott Loop Elementary will need to use them as the district decided to close the school and relocate the students. Wallace says drywall also has to be replaced each summer under the leaky roofs. Project manager Calvin Munt says the problem is compounding itself.
It'll find a place to leak, either through a crack in the decking or screw holes, nail holes, and then it gets in the system, and then it gets that insulation wet, and then the R value of it decreases, and it just is hotter and hotter and hotter, causing more and more melt and creating more leaks.
The district bond also includes several student safety upgrades, including new security vestibules at 6 elementary schools to require approved entry for visitors. The district has already installed 33 vestibules and are on track to build 22 more in the next 2 years. Last year's bond failed by a slim margin. In 1974, former Representative Thelma Buchholz made history as the first Filipino to be elected to the Alaska Legislature. Now, almost 50 years later, Representative Genevieve Mina is making history as Alaska's second. KTOO's Tasha Elizarde spoke with Mina about her journey to the state capitol and the importance of Filipino representation in Alaska.
It's a Saturday night in February at Juneau's Filipino Community Hall, and Representative Genevieve Mina is on the mic. The karaoke machine is blasting, and a quintet of Filipino community members are excitedly dancing backup behind Mina. Earlier that night, local cultural organization Filipino Community Incorporated, also known as Philcom, installed their next board of directors and introduced Mina, who is the second Filipino to be elected to the Alaska Legislature since Thelma Buchholz 49 years ago. At the ceremony, Mina addressed a crowd of legislators, staff, and Philcom members about the importance of Filipino representation in politics.
Filipinos are the biggest immigrant community in Alaska. However, we don't often see our stories and we don't often see ourselves in government, in pop culture, and in representations where we really want to see who we are.
Mina's own journey to representation was an unexpected one. She took office in January, representing parts of East Anchorage for House District 19. And despite being elected at age 26, Mina didn't always plan to go into politics. Back at her office in the Capitol, Mina said it was her desire to break out of her shell that got her more and more involved in the Anchorage community. And as the people she met encouraged her to run for office, Mina began to see it as a real possibility.
The more that I realized how much I loved doing this type of work of talking with people, building relationships, making policies into reality and leading groups, the more I felt that it was a natural fit for me to eventually run one day whenever the timing was right.
And Mina is no stranger to community service. When she was a preteen, she helped her mother and a group of Filipino-American assisting living home administrators sue the state of Alaska for shutting down their care homes. And while they lost the case, the experience shaped Mina's love for healthcare policy and eventually became grounds for her later aspiration to work in politics.
You know, it was really gratifying and fulfilling to be able to help someone understand what is going on when they're trying to deal with a very difficult system.
Both Mina's passion for healthcare and for the Anchorage community come from her parents. Her mother, an Ilongo woman who was the first in her family to go to college, became a nurse. And her father, an Ilocano who migrated to California, fell in love with Alaska after working in the state's canneries. And it's stories like that of her parents that inspired Mina to file HB 23, which would officially establish October as Filipino American History Month in Alaska. Mina is especially inspired by the story behind former Representative Thelma Buchholz, who was one of the first Filipino American women to be elected as a legislator in the U.S.
To learn about Thelma, to see the pictures of her talking to tall white men who have, you know, been in the building for a long time, and that was the first time that I really saw myself.
Back at the Filipino Community Hall, Mina shared her sentiments to an approving crowd. She pushed fellow legislators to consider what they can do for Filipinos in Alaska.
It's one thing to come to our events and to come to our dances, to eat our food, to say you love adobo and pancit, but our community also has needs, and our community also has issues that we're working through that are complex.
And most importantly, Mina challenges others to see the Filipino community as who they fully are. In Juneau, I'm Tasha Elizarde.
The salmon shark dissection was a fan favorite event at Kodiak's commercial fishing trade show Comfish before the pandemic. And before that, it was part of Kodiak's Whale Fest for years. This year, the dissection returned after a pandemic-induced hiatus. No sharks were available, but as KMXT's Brian Benoit reports, organizers used an inky alternative.
A squid measuring about 6 feet long arrived in a cooler and was laid out across a few tables at the Kodiak High School entryway. About three dozen observers gathered in fascination as the first incisions were made. Eloise Pryor was one of the excited kids nearby.
So, what did you think of the dissection?
It was amazing!
It was most likely a robust clubhook squid, according to the scientists. The crowd watched as they identified each organ from the squid's eyes to its stomach. Eloise says she was excited to help the biologists.
I learned that squids have three hearts.
The annual dissection used to be a Comfish tradition to educate and entertain kids and adults alike, but there hasn't been a dissection at the conference since 2019. Usually organizers dissect salmon sharks, which are named for their primary food source. But there isn't a commercial harvest for that species, so the event is reliant on incidental harvest or bycatch. Julie Matwiyu works for Alaska Sea Grant and led this year's dissection. She says no sharks were available this year, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration happened to have a frozen squid handy.
And then at the last minute, we didn't have anything, so NOAA was holding this for educational activity.
The squid was caught about 70 nautical miles east of Kodiak. The dissection lasted for about 3 hours, including cleanup. Matwiyu says they hope to host another dissection, but what animal the crowd will learn about next year is still yet to be caught. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venois.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tasha Elizarde and Jennifer Pemberton in Juneau, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Brian Benoit in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Hannah Bissett in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.